Welcome back, everybody. Okay, so fourth foundation. So we've kind of been seeing how this is all, how the Buddha saw how this can be helpful to us on our practice. And how useful this breath can be, touching on different parts of our experience. So the fourth foundation is, in a sense, the broadest of the four, because it covers this huge array of mental contents or mental phenomena, you could say heart-mind phenomena, that arise for us, that make up our humanness to a large degree. You know, we've got bodies, but more than anything else, for what's going on in our hearts and minds and our whole sense of identity and all of our stuff. So the Pali word is dhammas, D with a small d, dhammas, often translated as mind objects, fourth foundation, mind objects. And again, the essential intent is to cultivate mindfulness, take us away from obliviousness. Thus, we don't identify with what's arising. We can be present with it. We can see the three characteristics of impermanence, not self, and dukkha emerge inherently just from bringing our mindfulness to these aspects which arise. And that's how we find freedom. That's why the Buddha presented all this. And remember the promise at the beginning, this is a journey to Buddhahood, to the freedom that he had. So it's no small thing. It's no small thing. It's not just a parlor exercise. kind of like living rooms, right? Parlor games? I don't know. Anyway, it's not one of those. So just to review briefly, the first talk was the structure of the four foundations of mindfulness. And they're kind of the underpinnings of mindfulness practice. We looked at intent, to be ardent, clearly aware, clearly comprehending and mindful. It's continued throughout the sutta. Looked at the refrain 13 times, suggests the nature of insight. And we see arising and passing away of everything. And it brings us to not clinging to anything in the world. And then in the second, we looked at mindfulness of body, starts with the breath, but every conceivable position and status of our bodies as a way to cultivate mindfulness. And the third, we are looking at these subtle aspects of the second and third foundations, the Vedanas, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, the states of mind, these qualities of mind that we walk with are often hidden, and not really a matter of content so much, but states of mind, they're underlying content. They don't need content to be there necessarily. So kind of process of elimination, we can kind of see how we arrive at the fourth foundation, which has pretty much to do with the content of our minds and our hearts and how all that arises. And these are, you know, areas we identify with. We think it's me. We get confused, beguiled, distracted, all of the above, tormented, with, and sometimes blissed out, with the contents of our mind and hearts. And so, no surprise, the fourth foundation is made of lists. We are talking about Buddha Dharma here. So there's five lists, and this can be a little overwhelming in Buddhist world, to be sure. And just to amuse you, I was saying that this is one area where there's something called the agamas. It's the Chinese version of, this is the Pali canon in Pali, the agamas are a Chinese version. And in this fourth foundation, the list is slightly different. It doesn't have five, it has three. So this is something that Adalio talks about in the book, and it's an area, it's interesting to help discern out sometimes. You know, did the Buddha really say this or not? It's hard to figure out, but it's okay. I don't worry about too much. To cut to the chase, these five lists are the five hindrances, the five aggregates, the six sense doors, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the Four Noble Truths, which we're not going to go into all of, I promise you. But that's a lot of stuff. How does that have to do with our kind of gut experience of life? So I kind of want to focus on the first two, which are the five hindrances and the five aggregates, because they are very much, and we were already talking about the five aggregates over here, they have to do with our experience of being a human and the ways in which we identify with them or we're not mindful of them have a whole lot to do with a whole lot of trouble and confusion and suffering we get into. So they're really fruitful. And sort of the point is, the more we can cultivate mindfulness around these arisings anywhere across this whole spectrum of the four foundations, that's how we can find freedom. And it's sort of like, I think one of the things that is so wonderful about this practice is that it's self-sorting in the sense that whatever your particular sticky bit is, my particular sticky bit is, that's what will be in our face. That's the one we're, you know, challenged to be mindful of. That's kind of a beautiful thing about a group like this. We all got different sticky bits. And when we sit in circle, we kind of, oh, look at that. You know, I'm sorry that's yours. I'm sorry that's yours. I'm sorry this is mine. But they're all universal insofar as they're sticky bits. And they're all universal insofar as bringing mindfulness to them can help change our relationship with them. It can be more specious. We see that they're impermanent. We see that there's no self there. And we can see our way through dukkha just by bringing mindfulness to them. So that's kind of why these first two are really useful. Because the hindrances are, I used to avoid them like the plague, and I've gotten more and more engaged with them because I've seen what a doorway they are. I used to think, oh man, I don't want to do that. But actually, it's really useful. And in terms of shamatha practice, when people are talking about deep absorption, getting into the jhanas, the states of concentration, it's you can do that when the hindrances are bothering you. It's like black and white. If the hindrances are bothering you, you can't do that. Once you get past the hindrances, you can. So this is part of why cultivating mindfulness of the hindrances helps take apart or de-stickify, is that a word, their ability to obstruct us. And they describe specific qualities of mind and body that are challenges on the path. And the five aggregates describe five factors from which we build a sense of self. And the six sense doors, you know, how we contact phenomena, especially the first two, you can see how entangling they can be if we're lost in them. So I found mindfulness of five hindrances really helpful. So let's explore that a bit. So as you probably know, or some of you know, the five are, there's two opposites and then one on its own. So there's grasping and aversion. Those are opposites. Sloth and torpor, which is kind of together, like slumping, laziness, dark energy, and restlessness. Those are opposites, and then doubt. So desire and aversion, sloth and torpor, and doubt. And they arise not because something's wrong with us, or because something's wrong with the world. They arise because we're not Buddhas yet. If we were Buddhas, they wouldn't arise. They arise because we're conditioned beings right now. We're on the journey, but we're still, you know, we're still working through our patterns, our conditionings, our karmas, all that stuff. So they arise. So it's not something to beat ourselves up about, which is something we can do easily. Personally, I'm prone to sloth and torpor and restlessness. I can do both. And, you know, I sometimes beat myself up about it. Like, come on, dude, wake up. Or I'm nodding out, or I'm feeling, you know, or sometimes when I'm just ridiculously restless and can't sit still, I can be self-critical, but it's a waste of time. Better to just bring mindfulness to those, and to some degree, use skillful means to antidote, you know, if you're stand up, if you're experiencing sloth and torpor. Take a drink, take a breath, look up. You know, there's different things one can do. Or walking meditation if you're restlessness, but to be mindful of them is the best thing. Because we tend to concretize them as a failing of ourselves, concretize around it. But just to be mindful that that's happening, that is pretty cool. It's not me. It's this thing happening. Just like, you know, if you just broke your knee, that's a thing happening. And restlessness is a thing happening. And just be mindful of it. Don't have to worry about it's my thing. It's not your thing. It's just a thing. So to bring mindfulness to it really helps open up our relationship with it. And so we don't have to be so stuck. To be not mindful of it, just lost in it, that's, you know, that's not so helpful. So we want to bring mindfulness to it. And again, there may be some skillful things to do to counter that, as I'm countering that Buddha talked about in this arena. You know, like I said, standing up and different things. But mostly, since we're talking about this and the whole array of the four foundations, just bringing mindfulness to those hindrances is really powerful. Because I hear from people, and usually what people express self-doubt about in their practice has to do with the hindrances. You know, I can't stay awake. I'm always falling asleep. I'm restlessness, you know, and they blame themselves, and they feel like they're wrong, and they give up sometimes. That's really too bad. So we just, you know, accept them. It's just like stuff on the way. It's stuff we encounter. It's just how it is. It's okay. When we become Buddhas, we won't encounter it anymore. Those are things that will fade away. But we got a journey to do first. So bringing mindfulness to them, thinking of them as part of the four foundations of mindfulness, can really change our relationship with them. Oh, it's not this thing. It's actually what the Buddha said, be mindful of those. That's right there. They're in the fourth foundation. That's what he said to do. Be mindful of them when they happen. So when they smack you in the face, be aware of what's going on, how it feels, where you're feeling it. You know, just do that work right there. It's really transformational. And when we bring mindfulness to them, we start to see, go down a layer and see more accurately what's happening. Because what is restlessness anyway? You know, what is it? I mean, if I really start to look down, I feel like, you know, okay, it's a kind of a buzzing energy in my body. It's a whole bunch of bouncy thoughts. It's some twitchiness in my knees. A bunch of different parts. And to be aware of those parts, then it's easier to just be aware of it and not think it's me, because knees aren't me, buzzy thoughts aren't me, stuff happening. So it's really, the more we can bring our mindfulness to it, the less it's a coherent thing that we think is us that'll take us out, that'll distract us. Because, you know, in either of these cases, with the hindrances, the not so great choice is to give up. That's what it's really easy to do. I'm just too restless to say, I'm out of here. I'm going to go eat a Twinkie. Anybody eat Twinkies? Anyway, there's Twinkies. I remember Twinkies. But whatever it is your diversion is, forget it. I'm going to go eat a Twinkie, give up, turn on TV, something. So that's a time to just hang in there, you know, and go deeper. It doesn't mean being like, you know, Spartan, but to be wise. And to bring it into our mindfulness and see through it and see how it changes and shifts. That's what's so cool. And just accept, you know, this is our journey. If that's what's up right now, that's what's up right. That's our doorway. Whatever's up is our doorway. So we have, the only way we can walk through the doorways is to stay aware when they're up. It's just how the deal works. So these hindrances will, for many of us, be pretty strong at times. And it's just a great thing to take in as part of the journey, take in as an object of mindfulness, not a problem, not a failing, nothing wrong with us, just a deal. So maybe, and there, it's no accident these are, to my mind, in a line, the five, how they're arranged. Hindrances first, then the aggregates, then the sense doors, then the seven factors of awakening, then the Four Noble Truths. They get subtler and subtler and deeper and deeper. So the five aggregates, that's amazing stuff. The five aggregates are amazing and unique to the Dharma, for sure. Because the Buddha identified these ways that we build a sense of self from the phenomena we experience. And their body, and they go in, you know, it's interesting to look at the sequence. There's body, vedanas, and perception, volition, and consciousness. So think, you know, here we are, sentient being, we're aware of body, all sentient beings have some sense of body, whether they're a ground squirrel or a slug, you know, something, some sense of body. And if they have any sense doors, you know, think of, you know, we've all had a relationship with slugs, they have sense doors. And if there's something they contact, they either go back or they go forward because it seems pleasant or it seems unpleasant. So we have that, our slug nature. Perception, they probably don't do that. We do that, but we look at a color, we know it's green, whatever, or we look at a thing, we know that's a microphone, we perceive it, we put it together, microphone. I mean, it could be, you know, it could be a ice cream cone made of black ice cream that hasn't melted yet, but I think it's a microphone. So my perception identifies it right at the moment as a microphone until otherwise convinced. So it gets subtler, and then mental formations volition was the different words are used. Volition or mental formations, it's when we're thinking about stuff and planning stuff and creating, putting all this together and making plans and our whole mental fabrication that we humans do. I don't know if dogs do it or not. You know, I'm often hanging out with my dog trying to understand what she's doing. I don't know. I honestly don't know if she thinks about stuff or she just feels in colors or what, or emotions. I mean, her emotions are so subtle. But I'm not sure if she has cognitive ideas or planning. It's really hard to tell. I don't know. And then consciousness, those five. But the place where we get confused as sentient beings is we get in the mix of those and then we concretize them as me. And then we got a big me that we've concretized around a self, an I, that we stick to, we defend at all costs, we want to get the good stuff and make the bad stuff go away. If we encounter someone, if difficulties arise in us and there's some with something, they caused it and they're the enemy and we're not, all that kind of splitting and concretization and sticking, all that stuff happens around these five. So to be aware of them just when they're happening is incredibly amazing, because then we can deconstruct our sense of self on the fly, so to speak, in little bits and contacts and bits as we go along. And anywhere along that progression, you know, body, that's not me. What about vedanas? That's not me. That's just something that's happening. What about mental formations? Maybe that seems like maybe it's me because I'm thinking, kind of, or perception. Perception, not so much. Mental formation, more so consciousness, that's, as we were talking about earlier, that's a tricky one. Oh, that's me. I'm conscious. Well, but maybe not. That's just a function happening. So the more we just take that apart, I mean, it's kind of freaky when your sense of self falls apart. It's kind of freaky, kind of scary. But it's kind of profound too. And this takes you in that direction. So, you know, that's why it's part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness. It's a huge doorway. And just in the middle of, you know, all of the difficulties of life and our difficult negotiations with the people we, you know, we love the most or sometimes the most difficult, right? Just in that stuff, that's where the doorway is. Just to bring up your mindfulness. I mean, I, you know, face to face with my wonderful wife, I really try to bring up my mindfulness right there. When, you know, we actually have a good time most of the time, and sometimes we don't. And sometimes we don't is like, okay, what do I got to learn? How can I be more conscious? How can I actually be present here? How can I not project my stuff onto her? Right? How can I be deeply patient and compassionate? You know, even if she's not. Sorry. So, but it's a great opportunity for sure. This is a understanding about the sense of self that the Buddha is a sutta. With, he has a dialogue, the Buddha has a dialogue with Susima, a monk who had been a wanderer and pressed the Buddha about the nature of awakening. And the Buddha says, therefore, Susima, any kind of form whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, near or far, all form should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Any kind of feeling whatsoever, any kind of perception whatsoever, any kind of volitional formations whatsoever, any kind of consciousness whatsoever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, all consciousness should be seen as it really is, with correct wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Seeing thus, Susima, the instructed noble disciple, experiences revulsion toward or dispassion toward form, toward feeling, toward perception, dispassion toward volitional formations, dispassion towards consciousness. Experiencing this, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, his mind is liberated. When it is liberated, comes the knowledge, it is liberated. He understands, destroyed his birth, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more for this state of being. There's countless places in the suttas where the Buddha describes the journey to awakening, how the falling away of the concretization falls away and awakening emerges. This is one of many, but it's a very beautiful one and particularly adheres or corresponds to these five aggregates. And I offer this simply because here we are at the tail end of the four foundations of mindfulness. As the Buddha said, this can lead to awakening. You get more of a sense of how subtle, subtle, subtle this starts to get. Back in body, it wasn't so obvious, right? This is getting kind of obvious. This is like taking apart the ways that we concretize and get stuck and forget and not, don't see yet who we actually are or what we actually are, which is Buddhas. We just don't see it yet because we have all those obscurations and everything in the way. But that's kind of a beautiful sense of just bringing mindfulness to these very qualities that emerge in our minds and hearts, to the hindrances and the skandhas and the sense doors as they arise. Those are the doorways. And in the same way, you know, there's a way in which the five skandhas are kind of hidden from us, operating in the background, making up our sense of self, unless we take the time to notice and bring them into our mindfulness. So it takes a little work, a little step, a little stretch, but it's really worth it. So there's just a whole, you know, a whole array here, a whole continuum of all these different aspects to bring awareness to. And, you know, I'd really recommend studying this. You know, those books are amazing. The one by Joseph Goldstein is really amazing. The one by Anilayo. Those are both. In fact, Joseph quotes the Anilayo book a lot in his book. So they kind of pair up in a way. And Anilayo wrote several other subsequent books about different aspects of the four foundations, how to work with them on a path. So he's amazing. But it's one of those things that will keep revealing itself to you. You know, work at it, and because it's kind of easily forgotten about or kind of counterintuitive with how we normally proceed in life, it's easy to forget. So it's worth kind of bringing this up against over and over again. So what's the closing message is be mindful of whatever arises and thus be free. And we have a few minutes for any, so we're going to have a, if any questions about our thoughts, whatever, about any of that, about 5 minutes, and we're going to sit for 15, then have a couple of chance for closing, a few like announcement thoughts and like that. So anything come up on any of that, or are you all in Zoom world? I'm so honored because this amazing woman has been practicing for decades, and so on. Thank you. Eric and
I just have one quick question.
Hang on a sec.
Some traditions make a particular emphasis on awareness of awareness. So that would that be that's covered in consciousness of the in the aggregates, the fourth foundation.
Maybe that's kind of how I think of it. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that gets in a slightly blurry area that I'm not sure. But yes, it's a great, it's a wonderful thing. I mean, it's a great thing to do to be. It almost inherently starts to arrive that when we're being aware of all these specificities, to at some point become aware that there is awareness of them, to shift into awareness of awareness, which sounds convoluted, but it does. Ute Janiya, who's Burmese, talks about that a lot, and that shows up in a very similar flavor in Dzogchen practice, which is essentially about being aware in the Nyingma tradition in a completely different school that evolved, but somehow are seen kissing close, which is pretty cool. Yeah, so it's an area I'm exploring myself, trying to get that discernment. Yes, sir. And how handy is this? And you can sit if you wish. Yeah.
That was kind of an overview question. So from what little I've read, there's been a lot of awakened beings. The Buddha does some teaching and then a bunch of people become awakened. So how does one know if one is awakened, or how does one know if other beings
right.
are awakened?
Two very different questions, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And I'm not awakened, so I don't know on the first one. But I think we do get glimmers. I think the hints, the tastes are really important. You know, the little bits of awakening happening to people. So I'm really believe in that. It's a wonderful book, The Heartwood of the Bodhi Tree, by very interesting book that kind of bridges some of this by Buddhadasa, who was a great Thai master, talking about emptiness, when a flavor that almost seems Tibetan or Mahayana. But very much affirming the moments of seeing that anybody on the path has now and then. They happen, you know. And so those are moments of awakening. String those together, you're awakened. Do it all the time, you're awakened. You know, but some matter of degree. How do we know if someone else is awakened? Oh, that's a tricky one. You know, monks are, in terms of the Vinaya, for a Theravada monastic to claim some awakening is one of the heinous non-virtues, and there can never be monks again. They're out of there. So it's a very careful area, and most Theravada monks won't touch it. But at the same time, in the suttas, there's all kinds of people, lion's roar, claiming their awakening. So I don't know. But I always have my antenna up for those who are the most dissembling about I. If someone's saying, I have accomplished that, then wait, forget it. Because there is no I who awakens. They already canceled themselves out if they're talking that way. Sometimes you hear people speaking in a very matter-of-fact way about what they see or what can be seen, and you go, whoa, this person is seeing what they're talking about. And I've been around people who are, you know, some great beings, and it's just second nature to them. They're just talking about, well, you take the steering wheel of the car and you go left and it goes, you know, that's how we are. So it's that second nature that it seems to them completely obvious, and you go, woo. So I take that, and it's important because here in 2025, I mean, my heart goes out to young people. I've been talking to some teachers with AI. There's a lot of young people who say, oh, it's smarter than me. Why should I even bother? You know? I mean, it's technology. There's no spirit. There's no consciousness there. It is just technology. Unplug the servers and it's over. There's nothing other than digital code. But they think it's smarter than them. And they haven't been able to see their possibility as conscious beings. So y'all are here because you have some sense of that. So it's wonderful to see, you know, keep your antenna up, and, you know, I would suggest go to Clear Mountain or, you know, Sims. I'm a little bit taken with the monastics there because they're just pedal to the metal, like nothing else. That's it. They're amazing. I mean, the two ones here, but also the visiting ones are all pedal to the metal and in terms of focus, and see what your heart tells you about to what degree there's an awakening happening. I think there is. Maybe along the way, maybe there are stream enterers, maybe there are, you know, there's various stages, non-returners and all that kind of stuff. But I will say one more thing. When I was in Thailand, we were 2 weeks in three different monasteries and visited a couple of others, but pretty much embedded in three different Thai monasteries. It was really kind of an amazing. And Ajahn Ganha in particular, he was amazing to watch. I was like, oh my God. Because he had this quality, I don't know what it was, he just reached out to people and lifted people up just nonstop. I talked to some of the monks and they said, one of the monks, a German monk, he said, I've never seen him ever do anything for himself. And it just, I mean, we arrived, me and Jason, we literally arrived. 2 minutes later, Ajahn Ganha was in the side of a pickup truck because they're doing construction, and he comes over, he sees us, he waves us over, and he's giving us cookies and juices and things out of the side of the truck, and then we, you know, said thank you, and then 5 minutes later, they said, Ajahn Ganha wants you to come up to his kuti, so boom, we're in his kuti. We'd arrived like 7 minutes before. He spent like an hour with us and just poured this loving thing with us, and then over the days we were there, there was these different groups from Asia and groups of, you know, Chinese people. He kind of like after the meal, a whole bunch of the visitors would gather and he'd kind of scan around and say, how much of you, you know, oh, half of you speak Chinese. Okay, all the Chinese people come up with me. And he had to do this whole thing. So he just kept this incredible, flowing, loving, flexible thing. So some people think he's an arhat. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, you see what the proof is in the pudding. I think that's a technical Dharma phrase. Isn't that the Dharma thing? Proof is in the pudding. Okay.